Assalamu alaikum and peace be with you. Welcome to this episode in our series on the use, misuse and abuse of jihad in Islam, an Islamic textual and historical analysis of the contentions and misconceptions regarding the concept of jihad, the Islamic law of war and peace, and the spread of Islam. I am your host, Muhammad Nuruddin Lemu, and with me to discuss today's topics are two of our distinguished fellows and facilitators of the Da'wah Institute, Brother Nasir Bello and Sister Salatu Suli. You are both most welcome. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the previous episode, we started to look at the subject of the laws of war and peace that regulate the conduct of warfare, that regulate the behavior of military when it comes to actual combat. What are the do's and don'ts, even when warfare has been justified? What are those teachings of the Quran and Sunnah that ensure that when fighting has to be undertaken, it is not done in a wanton, arbitrary way that ends up achieving objectives that have nothing to do with the objectives of Islam? And so we looked at non-combatant immunity, at the various categories of people that the Quran and the Sunnah make it clear should not be fought. And there, what it helps us is with identifying when Sharia is being abused or misused, but it also helps us understand and reinforce what we found in the Seerah, which is that fighting is only against hostility and aggression, against oppression that is intolerable. Today I'd like us to look at another of the rules of war and peace that relate to the regulations surrounding the type of weaponry, the type of weapons that are permissible in Islam and in the Islamic law of war and peace. I would like us to look at why are some types of weapons prohibited? What's the objective? But before we pick those lessons, could you share with us some of the Islamic rulings from the Quran and Sunnah, the actions of the Prophet and the Sahaba, regarding the question of weapons being permissible or not permissible in a legitimate jihad?
I think when we say weapons, particularly when we reflect to the time of Rasul sallallahu alaihi wasallam, where weapons that were used actually are very simple ones, and they are really not that developed. They are quite very simple things, because if you look at the available weapons, then they are swords, they are, you know, bows and arrows, you know, very simple tools that they actually use. And that is when it comes to one-on-one combat that usually exists amongst people that are fighting. And if you look at from the bigger perspective, they use like what they call the primitive weapons of mass destruction, the mongrels. They use sometimes fire to break fortress, or maybe water as a mechanism or as a medium.
Mongrels are these catapults,
yeah,
the big.
Yeah, the catapults that you would always see. Sometimes in movies, when they are showing what happens in primitive societies. So they are very simple, you know, tools that don't, that can't actually inflict severe damage. They have limited impact when it comes to the way they affect or they harm the enemy or the other.
Compared to
what exists in our modern day. And again, another important thing for us to just, you know, reflect the context of the time of Rasul sallallahu alaihi wasallam and the companions. Often these battles, you know, happens in a very open space, in a very place where it's far away from, you know, non-combatant women, children, so it's an open place. But even with that, what is interesting, if you look at the history and you look at what is available in our jurisprudence, you would find laws and rules established that guide how you, what you use and how you use it. Scholars and jurists are really concerned about primarily non-combatant, ensuring that whatever is used, that innocent people, non-combatant, even within the camp of the enemy, are not in any way harmed. And Another thing they look at or they are concerned about is the property of the enemy itself. Mm. That it is not right for you to destroy the property of enemy just because it was the property of the enemy. Mm. So that is why you will find rules and regulations around how method use, the kind of weapons use, and so the thinking for me is, if with these primitive weapons, with this very limited, you know, skills in terms of methodology of attacking the other and inflicting harm to the enemy, scholars are concerned about, non-combatants are concerned about property. I think it is even a greater concern in our contemporary time when you have sophisticated weapons that can, you know, create a huge damage indiscriminately. Mm. You look at the range, you look at the quantum and the volume of damage that it can afflict. And another interesting thing is, if you look at how early scholars were seriously and heavily debating over the use of whether on whether you can and when you can, if you can, use poison-tipped arrows in fighting the enemy. Or when they begin to talk about this issue of weapons of mass destruction, the primitive ones, the catapult that we are talking about, the issue of plodding, using water to break the fortress of the enemy. You would find them, you know, debating over these issues. You would find them coming with, you know, difference of opinion. Some will say, sometimes contradicting opinions about these particular issues. Some will say it is absolutely prohibited. Others will say it is reprehensible, it is makruh, basically. Others will say, well, it is permissible, but if it becomes militarily necessary, that it is the only option, you cannot do otherwise, then that is the only situation when you have to do it. So this is quite amazing, looking at, despite how primitive these things are, how limiting it is when it comes to the damage they can, or the harm they can afflict the enemy, yet scholars are concerned about these things and setting up rules that will guide the process and usage of these kind of tools.
So now, what would you add to this?
When one thinks about the comparison between the primitive tools, even the ones that could do more than just hit the enemy, and you compare that with modern day weapons of mass destruction, they are worlds apart. Because when we talk of modern day weapons of mass destruction, we are talking about bombs. We are talking about nuclear firepower. We are talking about chemical weapons as well, and biological weapons that once released, they can't even be controlled. You can't say you are carrying out something that will function with precision and hit the exact combatants that are allowed within Islamic law. Therefore, when one says, or somebody might put forward the argument that if the mangonel was allowed in the past, that was a weapon of mass destruction for it at that time, then weapons of mass destruction should also be allowed today. It would appear that, yes, in this case, wouldn't work. That is analogy, reasoning by analogy wouldn't work, because they might both do more than harm the combatants. But the scale of destruction is far broader, which is the point after all. And another area aspect in which they differ is because bombs and so on are so destructive, so capable of wiping out entire cities. Once one country acquires the capability, other countries feel the need to, because that then leaves them vulnerable, which is what triggers the arms race that we saw last century. And it's still on now, just maybe done more quietly. For these two reasons, it's therefore important to move away from just qiyas and say what other tool of Islamic jurisprudence might apply in this case. Times have moved on and it requires fresh ijtihad. Because as Al-Dawoodi, a scholar, mentioned, he said that majority of the classical scholars, as well as the modern scholars, they actually feel that based on the Islamic law of reciprocity, if the enemy is going to use weapons of mass destruction, then the Muslims can too. Be that as it may, what we see though is, for some people, they go beyond just the use of weapons of mass destruction, and they also extend to carrying out attacks in urban areas. areas heavily populated by civilians. This is because they are going by law of reciprocity. But if one were to consider other things, other tools, consideration of public interest, public benefits, it might lead to a different conclusion. So as I mentioned earlier, this is an area definitely where there's need for fresh liquidity. So much has changed so rapidly that the former rulings need to be re-examined. After all, there's no denying that with the change in context, there needs to also be change in fatwa or ruling.
And I think, you know, just the point you're making, we do have clear hadith where the Prophet prohibited killing with fire. You know, that only Allah has that right to punish with fire. And so some have looked at that as, but weapons that are causing fires. I mean, what is a bomb? It's an explosion of fire. What's a nuclear bomb? It's fire. And that if that is haram, then this is haram. And for some to try and say, okay, but it's a lesser evil. The big moral dilemma is, using former weapons, you know, scholars would say, well, okay, if it's absolutely necessary to use those weapons of mass destruction, like fire and flooding, those type of weapons, when it's a lesser evil, some would say, well, therefore, today also, when it's a lesser evil. But when those scholars were speaking, if they were to use mongonels or these big catapults, they would probably kill 1%, 2%, 5% of the enemy, and maybe even civilian casualties. And some could say, okay, well, lesser evil. When we think of modern weapons, they would kill 100% of it'll flatten a whole city. Some nuclear weapons, you know, modern nuclear weapons handle a radius of over 15 kilometers. Some even more. And according to studies, the nuclear capability that human beings now have in form of weapons, less than 1% of our nuclear weapons, if those are to be detonated, it's enough to cause a nuclear winter. It's enough to raise so much ash and dust into the atmosphere that we will go back into the ice age. You know, so the need to really move away from some tools like just qiyas to say, well, under the circumstances is okay, then also today, and to look at probably tools like maslaha, public interest, the greater good. And it's definitely not an easy decision. It's not even just lesser evil, greater evil. It's great, great evil versus great evil. It's very difficult decisions that need to be made, and a lot of critical thinking required when it comes to this. But I think the key point being is the fact that scholars of the past were concerned, the fact that we have the prohibition or the discouragement of using certain weapons that are not enemy combatant specific, the discouragement of using some of these weapons, prohibition in the case of others, I think indicates the sensitivity of Islamic law to ensuring that war and the weapons used should not, you know, have contrary objectives. You can't say we fight those who fight us, but the weapons we're using seem not to care. They fight and kill everybody. So the need to really be sensitive to this subject area. Along the same lines, and you've already touched a bit on property, what exactly does the Quran, what do the Quran and Sunnah teach regarding the immunity of enemy property and this prohibition of destroying houses, buildings, farms, you know, just why, if it's enemy, well, why can't you? What are the rules there?
Okay. We know from the scholars and from the standards of Islam, when we talk about the higher aims or objectives of Sharia, the Maqasid of Sharia, that's one of those things, one of those essentials of life that Sharia aims to protect is property, the property of people. And as we've said before, if the aim of war is to fight those who fight us, their property is not fighting us. That's one. Secondly, we then look at what does Allah say in the Quran about this issue of destruction, of wastage. It's a general and well-known principle in Islam that Allah hates wastefulness. And wanton destruction of property is wasteful, because destroying the property might actually demotivate the enemy, which is why some do it. However, does one need to go that far? Now we look at a verse of the Quran, Surah Al-Baqarah, verse 205, where Allah describes a certain kind of person. He's actually describing the munafiqun. But he then also mentions, Allah mentions that such a person, when he turns fasiq, he comes forward as though he's doing something good. But when he turns away, he goes about the earth, causing fasad, that's corruption on the earth. And Allah actually mentions that he destroys plants and he destroys cattle. And Allah does not like the corrupt. Here we see the person who is corrupt is described as someone who causes destruction on the earth, but Allah even specifies animals and plants, like nothing is safe from this person's hands. Now, when we connect this back to the conversation we are having, it stands to reason, therefore, that Islamically, for a battle to be considered just, for the means to be considered just, there has to be that conscious avoidance of this form of indiscriminate destruction. Al-Awza'i, a scholar, commented on this verse I just mentioned, Baqarah 205, and he said that it's therefore haram for Muslims to do any sort of tahrib. Tahrib meaning vandalism, wanton destruction, wasteful kind of destruction. He said it's haram for Muslims to do this in enemy territory because that is fasad. He says, as long as you see that fasad, then you can't do it, even in enemy territory. Abu Bakr radiallahu anhu actually gave a command when he was sending commanders into battle. He said, kill no woman. And then he mentioned, kill no children, do not kill the aged, do not cut down fruit trees, don't destroy date palm trees, don't burn them down, don't destroy buildings. And he said, don't loot. So he wasn't even focusing with that instruction on just preserve life as far as possible. He was then mentioning preservation of property, which includes preservation of plants as well. The fact that the use of force is restricted to such a great extent shows that the hostility is what has been fought against, not plants, not trees, not the property of people.
And I guess the property of people is not just the property of the individual you are fighting.
Yeah.
It also belongs to non-combatants. You can't, again, you know, this prohibition of fasad fil ard, destruction, vandalism, all of this.
Yes, because as we see in even modern day warfare, when the enemy is being targeted and then the infrastructure is being destroyed as well, even though you may not have touched the non-combatants, but you have put them into an instant state of darura, a state of great hardship, that you might as well be dragging them into the battlefield as well. And on the side of just considering impact, what that usually does is you just produce another generation of enemies, of people willing, ready to fight at all costs, which then perpetrates the conflict. Whereas the aim of Islam is to, you know, dial it down as much as possible.
And I think this is what this whole issue of, you know, just focus on fighting those who fight you. That question of proportionality and, you know, avoiding any form of collateral damage. What would you add, Mom?
I think the mere fact that in our tradition scholars even discuss about, you know, rules and regulations around the usage of weapon, the impact or the effect that might cause. Regulations around that suggest or clearly demonstrate that the justification for warfare in our tradition is really not about, you know, the enemy, his person. It's really not about that. Because if it were about that, there wouldn't, it wouldn't matter about the life of the people, what kind of harm, what are the limits that you should look into. And scholars will not begin to talk about making use of even the primitive weapons of mass destruction only if the enemy has it also and is willing to use it. Now, if you look at, you know, some of the rules around the usage of property, and it's interesting also, if you look at the hadith of Abdullah ibn Umar that was reported by Imam al-Nasa'i, where Rasul sallallahu alayhi wa sallam talked about when you kill, killing a sparrow or something that is even bigger.
Like a bird.
Yeah, like a bird, of course. Something that is even bigger without a just cost. Mm. Allah will ask you on the day of resurrection. Mm. The companions ask, what does it mean? What is just cost? He said, the cause of, you know, slaughtering a food, but you should not cut off the head and throw it aside. Basically, this idea of looking at wealth beyond the perspective of personal ownership. You know, we always talk about the idea of wealth in Islamic tradition is about custody. And therefore, whether it belongs to the enemy or it belongs to you, it is not really seen in the Islamic tradition as your own. It belongs to Allah, you are only a custodian. And that is why the concept of, for example, extravagance is really frowned upon in our own tradition, because you are expected to judiciously utilize it, because it doesn't belong to you. It belongs to humanity, it belongs to Allah, and you are only a custodian. So I think this is part of the reason why Islam is really conscious about, even if it is that of the enemy, the property of the enemy, you should be mindful of destroying it, because he is only a custodian of that particular property. And that is why if you look at jurists in the Muslim tradition, they prohibit, you know, burning or drowning beheads of the enemy, even during war. And one of the great, that is why you find the hadith of Ibn Abbas, where he said Rasulullah has prohibited destroying the behalf of the enemy. And one of the great scholars in our tradition, Ibn Qudama, argued that it is prohibited for you to, you know, destroy or to use the behalf of the enemy except for food.
Mm.
Or basically behave generally except for food, or if the enemy is using it to fight you, that is the only reason or the only situation that will warrant actually destroying it or touching
it. So there's that appreciation of the lives of bees.
Absolutely.
And so
absolutely,
for people who are into beekeeping, these beehives should not be treated as if, okay, because it belongs to the enemy, we can be destroyed. Yeah, these are living things. Just as you said,
exactly.
Even a sparrow or cows or animals.
Exactly. And that is why if you look at what jurists always say in the Islamic tradition, is that destruction of the property of the enemy, being it living things like crops, like animals, or even non-living things, you know, their facilities, their infrastructure, some goods they use, is prohibited for a Muslim to destroy. You are expected to do as much as you can to ensure that you avoid touching that. So it's not about just the life of the people. It's not about the life of the innocent ones and the non-combatant, but even the property of the enemy, because of this idea and the concept of wealth in our tradition.
So the default regarding destruction is that it is haram. Would there be any exceptions to this, Salah?
Well, there is one exception that we find in the Islamic rules of war and peace, which is where the destruction of property is considered a lesser evil compared to taking of lives. Because if you were to put it on a scale, you would say life first, property second. However, if this happens, it has to be strictly because it's the only way to cut down on the extent to which lives would be taken or lost, which is what you might call public interest still, or military necessity, where the destruction of such property is absolutely necessary to winning the war, or will shorten the duration of the fighting. And if this were to happen, it must be on the authority of the military commander, not some random fighter or soldier taking that decision, or some civilian on the Muslim side deciding it's allowed, I'll go destroy property and so on, I'll loot property. So even though this is an exception, the exception itself is within certain narrow confines. An example of this is actually taken from Sirah during the siege of Banu Nadir tribe, which we discussed before, where the Prophet actually ordered the cutting down of palm trees of the tribe. And it was seen that the cutting down of the trees, though going against something he himself had said already, but it actually was a way of reducing the casualty from a full out war. And the siege lasted for 6 nights and eventually ended without fighting when the tribe surrendered. Cutting of trees in this instance is then seen as an example of a lesser evil, because it achieved the aim of cutting down on the fighting or preventing the fighting altogether. Be that as it may, we come back to the same point with which we started the entire series. When is war justified? Who can you fight against? It's fight those who fight you. Not fight people of this tribe or this religion or that religion. Because as this particular issue shows, all the restrictions around non-destruction of property, it's very clear that the aim is to move towards greater peace. The aim is to fight against hostility, oppression, unjustified provocation, aggression, and the like. It's not about fighting those who are of a different faith.
I think, you know, what one gathers from all of this is, number one, people's property, just as the lives of innocent citizens, just as there is immunity for non-combatants, there's immunity for property. And it is only when property can be weaponized, when property or destruction of some property would help reduce human loss or casualties or bring a faster end to a possibly prolonged war. So I guess, you know, I remember reading more some time ago on this case of the Prophet cutting some of the palm trees. And when the enemy could see the consequences, that if you allow us to cut more, it's going to affect your harvest the subsequent years. So, you know, it was one of those economic losses that was better than prolonging the siege, but it shortened it. They realized, we'll surrender. But it wasn't all their trees that were destroyed. In other words, it's not destroying property for property's sake. It's only when you know this can help save more lives, reduce the costs of war, that it becomes a lesser evil. But again, as you said, even there, instead of it being just any arbitrary decision, it has to be calculated by the relevant officials that this is a lesser evil. And so that question of proportionality, but the general rule is leave people's property alone. And I think what this also tells us is when people in the name of jihad go and loot in the name of, oh, it's booty. It's not booty. Booty, number one, even booty is divided by the head of state, by the general. It's not I decide what is for me. But the moment you start taking civilian property, that is haram, blanket. It's not yours. You don't touch it. You don't touch their cattle. And so for people who do cattle rustling, you know, who steal other people's animals in the name of, oh, it's jihad, or to go and loot shops and say it's jihad, this has nothing to do with jihad. The related topic I'd like us to look at is the case of human shields, where sometimes the enemy would use some of their own citizens, or your own citizens, but usually would use innocent citizens as shields, as hostages, hide behind them, knowing that you are not allowed to kill innocent citizens. They hide behind them, whether to attack you from there or whether to protect themselves from the Muslim army. What are the rules in the Islamic law of war and peace regarding this subject of human shields?
The subject of human shield, which scholars would call tatarrus, and this shield could be Muslims and could be non-Muslims. It could be Muslims that are taken hostage, I mean non-combatants that are used as shield, or it can be non-combatants of the enemies that they can as well use to protect themselves.
So it doesn't actually matter which religion?
It doesn't, because non-combatants are non-combatants. That is the priority here. The rules that you would find jurists talking about in this situation, they look at the situation. First, they said if these enemies are using, are hiding behind these non-combatants that they use as human shields and they are launching attack towards you, then in that situation, it is permissible for you to fight back, but try as much as possible to avoid, you know, targeting the non-combatant. Because the implication of not acting is that it might, you know, lead to a defeat to the Muslim army. So that is the situation where scholars will say you can fight back, but be cautious. Try as much as possible to avoid attacking the non-combatant that they use as shield. In the other situation is the case where they use them as a shield to protect themselves and they are not attacking you. It's a sign of surrender. It's a sign that they are afraid of you. So don't abuse that opportunity to continue to launch attack to them. That in that situation, it is not permissible for Muslims to keep attacking. Why? Because you are not actually concerned about them. It is the hostility. It is the peace. It is that surrender that you are now after. And we have, you know, treated many verses around that. That when they choose peace, then you should also open up and accept that. So if they surrender, they are afraid of you, and that's why they hide behind this human shield. Mean there is not any fitna, there is not any threat. In intahu fa inna Allah ghafurur rahim. When they stop, Allah is unforgiving, Allah is merciful. Many verses of the Quran that talked about what we kept emphasizing, that the priority or the target, what justified the war from the very beginning, was not their personality, was not their identity, was about hostility. So if that ceased to exist, then automatically you should also try as much as possible to be considerate. And by being considerate here is for you to not attack when they use human shield as a reason for them to have, you know, to survive.
So here you are distinguishing between human shields being used as part of the offensive of the enemy.
Yeah.
In other words, they're using it really as a shield to attack you from behind, and human shield used as a defense where the enemy is actually trying to protect themselves, but they're not trying to attack you. So where they are on the offensive, if you allow them to continue and you say you will not fight back, they will destroy you. So in that situation, it is permissible to fight back, but as much as possible, avoid the human targets. And I think what that shows is still the concern for innocent lives, even in the heat. And even if the civilians that are used as human targets are actually civilians of the enemy, Muslims should, you know, be restrained. But of course, with the other side, if they are using it in a defensive manner to hide, then there's no permission there. Salah, what do you add to this?
I think just to add the point that the Muslim jurists were deeply concerned about human life. And inasmuch as they created this room for the exception to attack it, the enemy, when they had these human shields, they still tried to balance the need to preserve life, to uphold that sanctity of life, with the need to win a war, a just war. Because ultimately, the whole aim of a just war was also to protect and enhance the quality of life of people. We have seen in history times when people would actually abuse this concept of absolute necessity, military necessity, public interest, or collateral damage, and use that to perpetrate acts of war that do not sync or tally with the Islamic concept of a just war, or fighting in Allah's cause, or fighting to a standard that Allah accepts or Allah supports. Ultimately, we still see, even in the very debate itself or the very regulations they put in place for handling situations where human shields are used as a strategy for fighting the war, we still see in all these regulations and the conversations of jurists that there is a deep concern for preserving the essential purpose why a war should be fought in the first place under Islamic law, and to preserve life, regardless of whether the life in question is the life of a Muslim or a non-Muslim.
I think one of those things we learn from all of this conversation is it helps us really understand the justification for warfare. When is it permissible? And that even after it is justified, which is only against aggression, it's not against property. It's not against the whole civilization. It's not against people and their, you know, sources of water and electricity, and, you know, you leave infrastructure alone. You leave other creatures. In other words, anything that's not part of the fighting should be left out of it. Mm-hmm. And the discussion around human shields and the whole concern to try and avoid innocent lives from being harmed helps us appreciate even more that jihad, when it is justified, is not against people who belong to another religion. Because they belong to another religion. It is only against people who are actively fighting you, and you only fight them when you have to. But if they surrender and they want peace, Muslims have no permission to continue hostilities. I'd like to thank both of you for your contributions and insights. Jazakumullah khairan. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.